Well, hello, Saints. Well, last time we're looking at David's great sin, and we looked at how he fell with Bathsheba and how all of these events came about, and it didn't happen overnight. David should never have been there in the first place. He should have been with his men out at war. But how compromise can lead to neglect, and neglect can lead to sin. So we looked at chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, and we got up to about verse 5. So we're going to continue with that message again today, but what happens afterwards? David had already fallen to lust and adultery, but it's from here, it's what he does. What he does with the sin that he's already done, and it's David really trying to cover his tracks with him already have committed these sins. So in verse 5 of chapter 11, 2 Samuel, and the woman, which is Bathsheba, conceived. So she sent and told David and said, I am with child. So straight away you've got a problem. The girl's pregnant. What will he do? What can he do? It's decision time for David. Does he confess up and own his faults? Or will he try and cover his tracks? And unfortunately for David, he goes from blunder to blunder. He's already guilty under the law of Moses of adultery, which was punishable by death. And he tries to cover his sin up and he adds one sin to another and another. And this is the progression when we get into the life of unbelief and the life of sin. We just keep adding sins to the one that we've already committed. The Bible is very right and correct. In Jeremiah it says that the heart of man is desperately wicked and deceitful above all things. That's the natural heart of man, the sinful heart of man. It's desperately wicked and deceitful above all things. And you're going to get a little glimpse of this with in David. Remember, he's out of fellowship with God at this point. He's already committed adultery, but what he does from here governs what happens to him. So his first plan, he's going to try and cover his sin. So in verse 6 we've got, then David sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. Now when Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were going and how the war prospered. And David said to Uriah, go down to your house, wash your feet. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift of food from the king followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and he did not go down to his house. So David's first plan here to cover his own tracks and the sin that he's already indulged in was to actually get Uriah home. If I can get Uriah home, then he will go and see his wife. If he goes and sees his wife, then he will probably sleep with his wife. He's been out on the battlefield with the men. Hopefully, if he sleeps with his wife, then I could cover my tracks by the fact that the child possibly may be Uriah's. This is going through David's head. How can I get away with the things that I've already done? The first thing I have to do is I have to get Uriah home from the battlefield, and I have to make sure that he goes home to his wife. So this is his cunning plan. So in verse 10, so when they told David saying Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, did you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? So in other words, this man is doing something that is actually unusual. The most natural thing to do would be to go and see your wife from the battlefield. And David counted on the fact that he could cover his tracks just by getting this man home, and he would do what most normal men would do, and that is go and see their wives, go and put their feet up, have a little bit of relaxation because they've been on the battlefield. But this man is no ordinary man. And in verse 11, he responds to David. And Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields, shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. What David didn't count on was Uriah was no ordinary man. And when you look at this whole story, you've got the man of God who's got a heart after God, that is David, living in sin. And he's attempting to cover his sin against someone who's Uriah. But this man is no ordinary man. He's a man of honor. He's a man of respect. He's a man of reverence. And the things that he says here is, I'm concerned about the ark. The ark of God is out in the fields. Israel and Judah, they're dwelling in tents. And my lord and all the servants, they're all encamped in the open fields. What a righteous man this man Uriah is. And the unfortunate part in this whole story is you've got a man of God, David, who is going to kill someone who is really upright, really godly. He respects the ark or the presence of God. He's got concern for the welfare of his fellow soldiers. They're all out in the tents. They're living in the open fields. And he says to himself, how can I do these things? How can I go and eat and drink and go and lie with my wife, which is the most normal thing to be doing for a husband? But he says, how can I do these things if the ark is in, if the presence of God is out in the open fields, if my soldiers are out in the open fields? He is no ordinary man. He is holy in his actions. David didn't count on that in his cunning plan. He thought he could cover his tracks in this way. But he can't. Uriah is no ordinary man. So then David has to come up with another plan. So verse 12, then David said to Uriah, wait here today also and tomorrow. So in other words, wait a couple of days and I'll let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. Verse 13, now when David called him, he ate and he drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his lord, but he did not go down to his house. So David's second plan, the first plan of David didn't come to pass because Uriah didn't do what he was expected to do. The next part of David's cunning plan was to actually get Uriah drunk. And his purpose in all of this is that drunk men let their boundaries down. They're more capable to do things that they shouldn't when they're drunk, or they just let their boundaries down and they're a little bit more wild or a little bit more, they're not so respectful in such a way. He just presumed that if he got him drunk, the next place that he would end up would be back at home with Bathsheba. But again, you see here that he didn't go to his home. He went and lay with the servants of his lord. So two of these plans that David has put in place to cover his tracks, to cover his sin, didn't come about. So in verse 14, you've got the next part of David's plan. Okay, plan A hasn't come to pass. Plan B hasn't come to pass. So now he goes to plan C. And this is the worst plan of all. To actually cover his tracks. David, he is almost using CIA tactics in what he does now, but he is adding sin upon sin upon deceit upon sin. So his plan is now, right, in the morning in verse 14, it happened that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. And he wrote in the letter saying, set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat for him that he may be struck down and die. What a terrible plan. So David is now guilty of lust. He's guilty of adultery. He's guilty of deceit. And now he's going to be guilty of murder because he is openly saying to his commander, I want you to put this man at the front of the battle, in the hottest part of the battle, where the fiercest fighting is, and then I want you to pull back from him and leave him alone. Don't back him up, but let our enemies take his life. So in other words, David is signing this man's death warrant. And Uriah has to carry this letter by his own hand to Joab. I don't know about you, but that's an awful daunting prospect of carrying your own death warrant, not knowing about it, but you're carrying your letter to someone who's in charge of you, saying that your life is to be done away with. Christ also, when I was thinking about this, Christ also carried his own death warrant. But the difference with him was that he willingly carried his own death warrant to the cross. He said to Judas in the upper room, "Depart and do what you must do." He knew he was going to be deceived. He knew that the chief priests had conspired against him. He knew what Judas was going to do. But irrespectively, he carried his own death warrant to the cross willingly and knowingly everything that was happening. But Uriah here, he doesn't know what's happening. All he knows is that he's been called home, he's been treated well, almost like a pig fattened up for the slaughter, and then he's sent back to the battlefield with a letter in his hand. From Joab's perspective, he must have thought, "What is this, David? You're the sweet psalmist. You're the one that writes all these psalms. You're the man with the heart after God. You're the one that leads us in the way, in the things of God. What on earth are you doing? What is this you're doing, David?" And Joab must have looked at this and thought, he's actually murdering. You know, Uriah is numbered amongst the 30 of David's mighty men. David is actually murdering one of his mighty men who'd been through him all through those wilderness journeys, running from Saul through the thick and thin, and he's numbered amongst the mighty men. He was a valiant warrior, someone that had served David. But David is blinded by his own sin, and he's blinded by trying to cover his tracks of the failure that he has done. And he's going to murder this man. So David never started out on this path, and that's the unfortunate part. He didn't start out on the path to murder Uriah. He started out on the path by neglecting what he had done, what he should have been doing, and allowing desires to turn into lust, and lust to turn into sin, and sin to turning into deceit and more sin, which then turns into murder. This is just a progression that goes on and on and on. Just as James says in his epistle, that sin is not barren. It's never barren. It always gives birth to death. It starts with something, but it continues. It's always giving birth. And if you stay in it, just here, David didn't start off to murder Uriah, but this is where it ends up. It just keeps giving birth to one failure, more deceit, more sin, one after the other. So what happens is that Uriah gets put into the battle, and the men pull back from him, and he's killed. And then the message comes back to David about the war, and the message is given by Joab that Uriah is dead also. In verse 24, the archers shot from the wall at your servants, and some of your king's servants are dead, and also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So Joab made it clear to David that the letter that he had given had been completed, had been fulfilled. Uriah, who you wanted to die, is now dead. So in verse 26, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. So now that the act was done, David's cunning plan was all covered. He got away with it. All was looking good. Uriah's gone. Bathsheba's now in David's care. And it all seems good, except for the very last verse in verse 27. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. God was watching, and he is always watching, and he is displeased here, it says, at David's actions. See, David, in all of this, hadn't really counted on the fact that God was watching everything he had done. He thought he had gotten away with it. Joab knew what David was doing. Bathsheba knew what David had done concerning her, but probably not concerning Uriah. How much did Joab know? We don't know. But when he heard, when Joab would have found out that Bathsheba had been taken into his care, he probably would have put two and two together. But at this point, David thinks he's got away with it. His sin is covered up. But God is always watching, and God was displeased. And this is the truth, saints, that nobody gets away with sin. No one gets away with it. In the book of Jude, in his epistle, which I'm thinking of doing maybe after David, there's this constant theme through there that no one gets away with sin. That God is always watching, and he sees all things. Here's some scriptures to consider. Proverbs 5:21. The ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. Proverbs 15:3. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good. Proverbs 20:17. Bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth will be filled with gravel. Isn't that the truth? And David is about to realize that bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man. In other words, all the deception concerning Bathsheba and Uriah, he thought he had gotten away with it. He's now got Bathsheba back in his own, listed amongst his wives, number 8. And he thinks everything's fine. He's gotten away with it. But that proverb is true. But afterward, his mouth will be filled with gravel. Bread is nice to eat. Gravel is horrendous. One you want to digest, the other one you want to spit out. And David is going to be disciplined by the Lord, and his experience is going to be like eating gravel. Something you just want to spit out and wish you'd never put in your mouth. But this is what sin does to us. It deceives us. We're lured away thinking this is going to be good, but afterwards it tastes like gravel in the mouth. Hebrews 4:13. There is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of whom we must give account. I'll read that one again. There is no creature hidden from his sight, meaning God, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. God is always watching. Every intent of the heart, every action we make, every path that we consider, the things that we do, he sees it all. And we have to stand before him one day and give an account for our lives. No creature's hidden from his sight. And the last one is Hebrews 13:4. Marriage is honourable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. No one gets away with sin. David had committed adultery, and by that, under the law, he was punishable by death. But now he's actually added to that by outright murder of Uriah. And God was watching, and God was displeased. So then you get to chapter 12. And there's a period of time in between David committing these acts, Uriah being killed, and Bathsheba coming into the home. And it's about a period, they reckon, of about a year. So a year goes by. And before before the Lord sent Nathan to David, you've got this whole year. Why so long? Why did God not send Nathan straight away? If that was you and I, we would have sent the prophet straight away, tell him what he's done, get it all cleaned up. But God didn't do it that way. He actually allowed a year to pass by before actually sending his prophet to his servant. A whole year. And he allowed in that year David to suffer the consequences of his sin before he sent Nathan. David writes three psalms concerning this whole event with Bathsheba. They are Psalm 38, Psalm 32, and out the other side of it, Psalm 51. But David, in the Psalms, talks about his experience or how he felt during this year. So in Psalm 32, in verses 3 and 4, he talks about it, how he felt during this year. He says, "When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer." So here you've got that there's a period of time and David is suffering. God's hand of displeasure was right upon David for a whole year so that David may acknowledge his sin. You've got David saying here, when he kept silent, he didn't acknowledge his sin. He tried to cover it up. He kept silent about it. There was no confession before God that he had sinned. He just tried to keep it hidden away. But this was the outcome, that he said that his bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. This sin, unconfessed, it actually had an effect upon him physically. His bones grew old. He had no vitality. He had no spring in his step. He groaned a lot. So you've got both mental and physical suffering due to unconfessed sin in his life. He said that God's hand was heavy upon him. You see, there's a difference between the saved man and the unbeliever. There's a difference between a sheep and a pig. Now, a sheep will fall into the muck and it'll want to get out and clean itself up because it's not foreign to him. It's not normal for him. But a pig, when he falls into the muck, what does a pig do? A pig will roll over and over and over and swing home sweet home. A pig loves the muck. It loves to roll in it. And that is what the unbeliever is like. When an unbeliever sins, it's natural for him. It doesn't worry him too much. But when the believer sins, he's like the sheep that falls in. He just wants to get out and shake it off and go to a green bit of grass. So David here, even though he's silent, he's suffering. But God will never allow a child of God to get away with sin. There will always be a consequence of discipline that is upon him. Here, the hand of God was heavy upon David. Day and night, he had no joy. He was lifeless as in a drought. His bones ached. He groaned. And this is God's disciplining hand upon him. And he disciplines those that he loves. Now, I've got to say here that just because you may have physical stuff going on or mental stuff going on, it doesn't mean that it's due to unconfessed sin. Some people like to say that, and they always attack Job. You know, he must have sin in his life. This is why these things have happened to him. But that's not always the case. But in this case for David, there was a physical and a mental effect upon him with unconfessed sin. So he had effects in his physical body. Rotting bones. God's heavy hand, no vitality of life, and everything was dry as in a drought. Have you ever felt like that? Have you ever felt like that as a saint, where you've done something wrong, or you've kept something hidden, and you haven't confessed before the Lord or before men something that needed to be confessed. Sometimes God's heavy hand can produce these things, and it's there to actually bring us to a full repentance of our sin. See, God's hand is gracious and helpful when it uplifts, but when it presses down, it's awful on our conscience. It condemns us and it sucks the life out of us. But its purpose is that you may acknowledge what you've been doing and confess your sin before God. The other psalm that he wrote is Psalm 38. And I'll just read a little bit of there, because he really comes in verse 3. He says, "There is no soundness in my flesh because of your anger, nor any health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me. My wounds are foul and festering because of my foolishness. I am troubled. I am bowed down greatly. I go mourning all the day long. My loins are full of inflammation, and there's no soundness in my flesh. I am feeble and severely broken. I groan because of the turmoil of my heart." Here you've got David again, suffering under the fact of God's heavy hand, but it was because of the sin that he was covering. It was because of what he had done with Bathsheba and Uriah. So when you get to chapter 12 in 2 Samuel, a whole year has passed by. David wrote those two psalms during and his experience of that year, what it was like for him. Something had changed. It was just like what Proverbs said, that bread, what was the Proverbs? Bread gained by deceit is sweet to a man, but afterward his mouth will be filled with gravel. This is what David experienced during the year. But its purpose was that it might bring David to his senses. So a whole year goes by, chapter 12, and then the Lord sent Nathan to David. This would have been extremely difficult for Nathan to actually approach David. Yes, he is the prophet, but here is the king. But Nathan was obedient to God, and he had to go and confront the king with his sin. Not an easy thing to do. So in chapter 12, verse 1, "Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, 'There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. He ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveller came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him.' So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and said to Nathan, As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die.'" What a story. This is one of the greatest little stories in the Bible, and God has a way of actually cornering us at times. And the beauty about the story is that when you read it, it causes all of us to rise up at the injustice of the story. Here you've got a rich man, he's got everything. He's got abundant flocks, he's got abundant herds, he's got everything, and contrasting that with a poor man who's got absolutely nothing. All he has is one little lamb. And this lamb, he brought it up, he nourished it. It came up, it brought up with his children. They fed it. It ate food from his own cup, food and drink. So it shows here that all he treasured was this one little lamb. He's poor, he's got nothing but this and his kids. And the traveller comes, to the rich man, and instead of the rich man giving of his own abundance, he's got everything he ever needs, he's got more than enough, he takes from the poor man the one thing that he has. And all of us, when we read this story, we rise up and we say, what a shocker. How dare that guy do such a thing? You rise up at the injustice of what the rich man did. How can he take all that a poor man has actually got when he's got abundance? So what the story does is it causes you to rise up and say, what that guy did is unacceptable. That's despicable. That's a terrible thing to do. And it's a beautiful story because David reacts exactly the same way that you and I would react. David rises up and he calls for judgment. He says that David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this thing shall surely die, and he shall restore fourfold for the lamb because he did this thing and he had no pity. David called for judgment to be given. This guy had to die, and not only die, he had to fork out of his own pocket before he dies and pay fourfold for the lamb. David was administering the law to this guy. He had to pay back fourfold and also lose his life for what he did. So this story, the beauty about this story is that it actually got David to actually judge and condemn himself. At this point, he has no idea that the story is about him and his conduct. But the story caused him to rise up at the injustice of someone who had everything but took from someone who only had one thing. And the story is about David. David being the king who had abundance. He had everything he even wanted. He had 7 wives. He had everything. But yet he took from someone that only had one thing. He took from Uriah the very thing that he treasured, which was Bathsheba, his wife. See, David had no idea of his own sin or his own condition. It's amazing. This story got him. It nailed him. David had no idea that the story was about him. He had no idea that the story was about his sin and his condition and the actions that he had done. But, you know, we also are very like this at times. We'll hear something about someone. We're really quick to rise up and condemn others for their actions. We're very quick to rise up and judge the weaknesses in other people, the failures that have brought them down, the hypocrisy of others. Sometimes we're so blinded by our own sin, but we're really quick to judge the sins in another. We don't see our own state. We don't see the wretchedness of our own actions in our own heart. Just as David did here. He rose up straight away. This guy deserves to die when he's guilty of the very same things. Jesus spoke about this. Jesus said to the people, why do you worry about the speck in another person's eye when you've got a plank in your own? This is David. He's rising up at another man's speck when he's got a whole board or a whole plank in his own eye. He can't see his own wretchedness. He can't see the sin that he's been involved in. So then you get Nathan's response. And Nathan said to David, you, David, are the man. That must have come as an absolute bombshell to David. Those piercing words would have gone right into his heart. Nathan saying, you are the man. You are the rich traveller. You're the one that's committed this injustice. But quite often we are like that. We need something to open our eyes. We need the Spirit of God to come and show us our own condition. Sometimes we are blinded by our own sin or try to cover things up to such an extent. And we need the Word of God, we need the Spirit of God, and sometimes we need others, as in this case, to actually open our eyes and reveal to us what is going on, the condition. Just like Peter, he said, look, everyone else, Lord, is going to betray you, but not me. I'm made of sterner stuff than the rest of them. I'll never betray you. only to be weeping bitterly after a little servant girl said, "You are one of his disciples." Peter had no idea of his own wretchedness, of his own great boasts, of how weak he actually really was. Next minute, it's all exposed. Jacob, he was another one. Do you remember when Jacob was wrestling with the angel of the Lord? The angel of the Lord said to him, "What is your name?" And Jacob wrestled with him all night about who he was. His name means supplanter, means a trickster, deceitful, one who grabs at the heel to take. That was Jacob's nature. And he fought with the Lord all night. And in the end, God had to actually touch him in his thigh. He had to give him a physical injury to actually bless him. And then he changed his name. "Your name shall no longer be Jacob." But Jacob wrestled all that night with the angel of the Lord about who he was. But in the end, there was a blessing. And he was called Israel. So Nathan said to David, "You, David, are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. Verse 8, I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have given you much more." So in other words, God is saying to him, I've given you everything. I've done everything for you. Verse 9, why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You, David, have killed Uriah the Hittite with a sword. You, David, have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. David despised God's goodness. And Nathan lays the blame right on him. You are the man. It is you that have killed Uriah. It is you that has taken his wife. You can't escape here. You can't get away. This is you, David. Everything is boring down upon him. But it shows that he despised all that God had given to him. God had given him abundance. He'd given him everything. The kingship. He'd given him wives. He'd given him all of the house of Israel and Judah. In other words, he's like the rich man in the story. He had everything he all ever wanted. And it says here, why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil? You've treated all of the goodness of God to you and just thrown it away by taking one man's possession. Heavy words from Nathan. That would have been like a bombshell, that piercing, "You are the man," upon David. Now verse 10, now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I'll raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I'll take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. This is the consequences of sin. God is saying to David, there's going to be a consequence for your actions, for what you did is wrong. Yes, there's going to be you're going to have trouble, and adversity will come from your own house. And as we go through David's life, we see that with his sons, they rise up against him, Absalom. He's going to take his wives. What David did in secret, God is going to allow to happen in the open so that all Israel see it. These are severe consequences to David's sin. David hid everything, tried to cover it up. God is going to expose the whole thing. It's going to be all put out in the open. And we all have to live with the consequences of our sin. God will allow that. And we actually need that so that we own it. We have to own our own sin. And in verse 13, we get this wonderful little piece. So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also who is born to you shall die. That is the child that is conceived between him and Bathsheba. So the first part of this is, the great thing about this is that when exposed of his sin, David fessed up straight away. He realized that he was in the wrong. He realized that he had sinned, and he said, I have sinned against the Lord. And the wonderful thing is that Nathan had realized that God had actually put away his sin, and he shall not die, but he was going to have to suffer the consequences of his wrong actions. David writes Psalm 51, which is all out the other side after he had confessed his sin. And next time I want to have a look at that, because it deals with what we do once we've blown it. And we have all blown it. What is the worst thing that you have done? It probably wouldn't be what David has just done. You probably wouldn't have committed adultery and all the deceit in trying to cover your sin and then committing murder. How do you, as a child of God, pick yourself up after doing that? How would you do it after being guilty of all of that? We all have done horrendous things, some worse than others, but there must be a way for us to stand back up on our feet and follow the Lord Jesus Christ after failure. And David here, he starts by acknowledging his sin straight away. And God has put away that sin. Yes, you've got to suffer the consequences for your actions, but you've still got to get up on your feet and follow God and wear it and bear it, the failures that you've done and the consequences that they come about. So Psalm 51, I want to look at next time, because it's out the other side, and it's what David realized out the other side, and the greatness of God's grace toward you and me and David with our failures and with the things that we do that are wrong and not acceptable, but we can still continue on in God, walking in faith, having a cleansed life, but yeah, we still have to suffer the consequences of our actions. There will be a cost there, but we have a clean slate before God and we can continue on. So next time we'll look at Psalm 51 and what David learnt through this whole failure out the other side. And it's important because we have to learn from the mistakes that we make and the failures and the sins that we fall into. So I pray that you would see more and more in these passages, but I love the Bible because it gives you humanity, warts and all. And we're all like this, and we all fail, and we all sin in all different degrees. Remember what Jesus said in the Gospels? You may think, well, I've never committed adultery, I've never murdered. Jesus said, even if you lust in your heart after someone, you're guilty of adultery. If you hate someone, you're guilty of murder. Remember, sin is always birthed in the heart, and the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Even if you haven't acted on those things, it's our hearts that are wrong. But the good thing is that the life of Christ has come into our hearts. His heart and his life is not like that old Adamic nature. And as we trust in him and lean on him and rely on him to live his life through us, that will always dominate our sinful natures. So God bless to you all. And next time we'll look how David picked himself up off the ground and continued on to follow the goodness of God in his life. So God bless.